and verses 29 to 34. 1 Kings 4, 29 to 34. So with that brief reading, I'll now call upon our brother Roger Lewis to continue in the studies upon the life of King Solomon, and the example this morning to us is given of Solomon, the wise teacher.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, in the first of Kings chapter 4 then, as set before us today, we have these few brief verses at the end of the chapter that detail to us some of the information given concerning the particular wisdom that Solomon had. I suppose really the story begins back again in chapter 3, because you'll remember that in the first of Kings chapter 3, when Solomon had gone to Gibeon to offer sacrifice to God there, that he asked by means of request to God for wisdom and understanding. In fact, in particular, we're told in the first of Kings chapter 3 and verse 9 that Solomon said to God, "Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this thy so great a people?" And the speech pleased Yahweh that Solomon had asked this thing. And so the particular request that Solomon made was for the granting of wisdom, not simply that his own intellectual powers might be increased, but that specifically he might have the ability to give wise judgment in the nation. He wanted wisdom for the purpose of judgment. It was in order that he might discharge his responsibilities of kingship, and in particular in the matter of discerning the various facets of human life and of human characteristic which he was going to be called upon to assess in his capacity as king. So coming back now to the first of Kings chapter 4 and verse 29, and to those verses that we took up as the reading, you'll see therefore that verse 29 represents, if you like, the answer of God to that earlier prayer. And God gave Solomon wisdom. So here, in fact, was the granting of the wisdom that he had requested in the third chapter as God communicated with him. Now, we're told in the first of Samuel chapter 18 and verse 5 that David, his father, was renowned for his prudence. So Solomon's own father was already noted for a certain capacity of wisdom, and particularly that of prudence in conducting himself wisely in life. That's on his father's side. On his mother's side, of course, we remember that Solomon's great-grandfather was, well, who was Solomon's great-grandfather on his mother's side? It was indeed, wasn't it? His great-grandmother was, great-great-grandfather, rather, was Ahithophel, and we're told in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 16 and verse 23 that his wisdom was legendary. The ability of Ahithophel to give counsel was, says the divine record, as if one inquired at the oracle of God. So there was a certain, if you like, a certain amount of hereditary gift bestowed upon Solomon by virtue of both his father and his mother's line. But that's not what this verse says. This verse says that superadded to any hereditary gifts that he might have had, God gave Solomon wisdom. There was something very specific and deliberate about this. It was a divine gift, divinely bestowed. In fact, later on in the divine record, we're told that the kings of the earth came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And the first of Kings chapter 10 and verse 24 tells us that they came specifically to hear the wisdom which God had put in his heart. So it wasn't just natural talent or ability. This was indeed a specific divine blessing upon this particular man. And notice how the record stresses the largeness of how God blessed him. It says, God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, says the record. He had enormous ability. The RSV says, beyond measure. The Jerusalem Bible translation says immense for the word exceeding much. And somehow the record seems to add here superlative upon superlative, as if it can't bring in enough powerful words to describe the fantastic ability that this man had. He gave him wisdom and understanding, exceeding much, and largeness of heart. The phrase largeness of heart, the word in the Hebrew means literally to be wide or broad, width or breadth of heart. The NIV translates the phrase, a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. And I think that captures the sense of the original Hebrew. A breadth of understanding. It wasn't largeness of heart in the sense that he was simply a generous-minded person, but he had a marvellous expanse of understanding into an enormously wide variety of things. Now this phrase, as the sand that is on the seashore, is of course an interesting one, because that phrase is normally used to describe the vast multiplication of Abraham's seed. That's where it comes from, isn't it? Genesis 22. I'll multiply thy seed as the sand that is on the seashore. But on this occasion, this phrase that is normally used to describe the multiplication of the Abrahamic seed is here used to depict the innumerable facets and the endless diversity of Solomon's own thoughts. The endless diversity of Solomon's own thoughts. It was like the sand on the seashore, says the divine record. So you see, here we have a man who had enormous talent, and it reached out into all sorts of different things in the fields of architecture, construction, commerce, administration, statesmanship, politics, judgment, literary activity, intellectual development. In all of these things, Solomon's wisdom was to be seen. It's almost as if the record is telling us in this 29th verse that we can't have impressed upon us enough the outstanding breadth and width of this man's mind. And so in verse 30 it says, and Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt. And of course, one of the things that occurred as a result of Solomon coming to the throne, and partly because of the breadth of his mind, is that a whole new world, as it were, was opened up to the gaze of Israel. The wonders of Egypt, the commerce of Tyre, the romance of Arabia, the mysteries of Tarshish, the treasures of Ophir, all of these things were suddenly brought close because of the extensive contacts and the extensive worldwide operations of this particular man. But concerning his wisdom, we're told in this 30th verse, that it specifically exceeded the two most famous countries of the day who were noted for their wisdom. The wisdom of the East, of the Eastern peoples, and also the wisdom of Egypt. Now, of course, these countries were noted for their wisdom in all sorts of different ways. These two countries were famous for their skill in mathematics, in geometry, in physics, in chemistry, in astronomy, in engineering, but also in magic, in superstition. Solomon's wisdom exceeded all of that, brothers and sisters, because his wisdom, the key to Solomon's wisdom, was going to be that it was to be found on a different and on a higher plane to the wisdom of the countries that surrounded him. And so verse 31 says, for he was wiser than all men. The word men here is Adam. He was wiser than any other human being. But specifically, although it says he was wiser than any other human being, it is specifically in this particular verse, it means that he was wiser than any other wise man. Because the verse goes on to now compare him with others who were obviously noted for their wisdom. It describes Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman and Chalcol and Darda, the sons of Mahol. So here obviously were four preeminent sages who hitherto had been unrivaled in their ability in matters of wisdom. All of these names, by the way, appear in the record of the books of Chronicles. And we're not suggesting that the particular names in the book of Chronicles are these four, but what conclusion we do draw from that perhaps is that they were therefore probably all men of Israel. In other words, here were four outstanding wise men from the history of Israel to this point of time, and says the divine record, Solomon's wisdom exceeded the lot of them. But his wisdom was not just limited to exceeding the wisdom of the wise men of Israel, because the verse concludes by saying, and his fame was in all nations round about. So he was the greatest of the wise men, not just in Israel, but throughout the whole world of his day. Now, the thing that happened, we believe, as a result of all this, was that under Solomon's influence and championship, a new order of people sprang up in the nation of Israel. They were different to the two orders that so far had assumed prominence in the history of the nation. Up till now, the two key orders had been the priestly class and the prophetic class. The priests and the prophets, of course, were the two famous orders that had come down to us through the time of the history of the nation up till now. But with the advent of Solomon, we believe that a new order of people appeared upon the face of the nation, and they were known not as the priests, not as the prophets, but simply as the Hakamim, the wise. And so you'll see, for example, here in the book of Proverbs, chapter 1, to understand a proverb, the words of the wise, the Hakamim, and their riddles. Proverbs 1, verse 6. Again in Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 12, it says, a scorner loveth not him that reproveth, neither will he go unto the wise, the Hakamim. Again in Proverbs 22 verse 17, bow down thine ear, says the record, and hear the words of the wise, and apply thine heart to their sayings. Proverbs 22 verse 17. Again in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 11, the words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened. And notice this rather interesting reference in Jeremiah chapter 18 and verse 18, because now we have the three types of classes expressly compared. For the law shall not perish from the priest, nor counsel from the wise, nor the word from the prophet. So you can see that we now have a class of people known as the Hakamim, the wise ones, who are every bit as important in the history of the nation as the prophet and the priest. Whence did they begin? We believe that they originated from the time of Solomon, because he was preeminently the prototype of the Hakamim that would follow on from him. Now, it's not too hard just to look at those references again and to see the main point of what it was that these wise ones were about. You'll notice, for example, here in Proverbs chapter 1, to understand the words of the wise and their riddles. So the wise were noted for their profound sayings. Here in Proverbs 15, a scorner loves not him that reproves, neither will he go to the wise. So one went to the wise to obtain instruction, or if necessary, reproof. In Ecclesiastes here we're told that the words of the wise are as goads. So these wise ones were able to direct people into certain channels of life. And finally in Jeremiah chapter 18 here, what did they do? Well, they gave counsel, said Jeremiah. That was the role of the wise ones, to give counsel in the nation. And so they became the sages of Israel. And their principal concern was with the giving of prudent counsel in daily life. That's what the Hakamim were there to do, to give prudent counsel in daily life. And we believe that that order sprang up consequent upon the wisdom of Solomon as it was manifested in the nation from his time forth. Now, interestingly enough, the term wisdom that's used here and the term wise, the term chokam and chokamim, the terms for the wise ones and for the wisdom that they have, those terms are used quite sparingly up to the time of Solomon. And as far as people are concerned, only a very small group are described as wise ones in the time of Moses, and another handful of people are given the term in the days of David. But as soon as Solomon comes upon the scene, we find now that this term is going to occur 300 times in the divine narrative from Solomon onwards. It's almost, you see, as if with the advent of this king, we have an explosion of intellectual property in the nation. And here's the man that caused that explosion to take place. Solomon, who was himself the preeminent of all the wise ones that were to follow after him. So verse 32 goes on to tell us that he spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spake 3,000 proverbs, says the record. Now, of course, from the days of Samuel, the literature of the truth in Israel had begun to develop. In the days of the schools of the prophets, the matters of music and poetry had begun to come to the fore. When David came along, of course, his particular genius was in the writing of psalms and spiritual songs. But with the advent now of Solomon, Solomon was going to add a whole new dimension to the writings of the truth. And he was going to add the wisdom writings. And that was going to be a totally new aspect of the truth. So we have here, and notice this logical progression between three passages here. So we're told here in the first of Kings chapter 4 that Solomon spake 3,000 proverbs. But when we come to the book of Ecclesiastes, we find that not only did he speak them, Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 9 says, "And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge, yea, he gave good heed and set in order many proverbs." So whereas Kings tells us that he simply spoke proverbs, Ecclesiastes says, well, there was actually more to it than that. There was actually the seeking out and the ordering of proverbs. And for what purpose? That the people might be taught. You see, this was not the sort of wisdom that was simply going to be kept cooped up in a man's own mind. The wisdom that Solomon excelled in was that which was to be used for the guidance of the nation. That's what he'd prayed for right from the beginning. Wisdom that I might judge this people. And so that which was at first spoken, he spoke proverbs, was obviously now written down. He didn't just speak them, he wrote them down and he set them in order. And so as a result of that, we read in Proverbs chapter 1, "The proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom, to understand the proverb, the words of the wise and their riddles." And so we have the book of Proverbs coming into existence at this particular time. So these three passages really sort of tie together, don't they? The speaking of the proverbs in the first of Kings chapter 4, the setting of those proverbs in order, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, and now the writing of the book itself as we have it in the book of Proverbs, referred to here in Proverbs chapter 1. And even the term proverb itself was to gain a new dimension of meaning under the influence of Solomon. Does anyone know what the word proverb is? What's the word for proverb? The standard word for proverb in the Hebrew. I think that sounded right. Would you just like to say that again? Yes, it is. It's mashal. Now, the question is, what does the word mashal mean? Well, up to this point of time, the word mashal had covered a number of different things. If you come to Numbers 23 and verse 18, we're told in the days of Balaam, in Numbers 23 and verse 18, it says of Balaam that he took up his mashal and said, "Rise up, Balak, and hear. Hearken unto me, thou son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent." And so he goes on to speak the words that follow. Verse 24, "Behold, the people shall rise up as a great lion and lift up himself as a young lion." And when you actually look at this, you realize that the word mashal here is actually being used in the context of a prophecy. So mashal meant, or could mean in this particular context, a prophecy. Numbers 23 verse 18. And the word mashal is used throughout this whole sequence of Balaam's prophecies of the future of Israel. When we come to the book of Job, for example, in Job 27 and verse 1, we come across the term mashal again, but this time in a slightly different context. In Job 27 verse 1, it says, "Moreover, Job continued his parable, his mashal, and said." And if you read on from what Job starts with in Job 27 verse 1, what we have here is a word poem. This is actually one of Job's poems in this chapter, but it's described as a mashal in the first verse. So the word mashal could be a prophecy, Numbers 23. Mashal could also be a poem or a song, as here in Job chapter 27 and verse 1. If you come to Isaiah chapter 14, we have the word mashal used in a third different context in Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 4. It says in Isaiah 14 and verse 4 that thou shalt take up this mashal against the king of Babylon and say, how hath the oppressor ceased, the golden city ceased. You'll see that the margin says for a proverb on this occasion, although it is mashal, thou shalt take up this taunting speech. And if you read Isaiah 14, you'll find that what Isaiah 14 really is a satire upon Babylon. So mashal could be a satire upon a particular subject, and certainly it's used in this particular way in Isaiah chapter 14. So a mashal could be a prophecy, Numbers 23. A mashal could be a poem, Job 27. A mashal could be a satire, Isaiah chapter 14. And perhaps just one final one, Ezekiel chapter 17. The term is used in Ezekiel 17 in the prophecies of Ezekiel in a fourth context. And on this occasion, we're told in Ezekiel chapter 17 and verse 2, it says, "Son of man, put forth a riddle and speak a mashal unto the house of Israel and say, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, a great eagle with great wings, long-winged, full of feathers, which had diverse colours, came unto Lebanon and took the highest branch of the cedar and cropped off the top of his young twigs and carried it into a land of traffic." And what follows on in Ezekiel 17 is actually a fable. It is a fable. In other words, a fanciful story, but that's going to have a certain principle behind it. A little bit like the fable or the parable of Jotham. But it's described here as a mashal. So you see, the term mashal could apply to a number of different things. Because we're familiar with it in the book of Proverbs, we tend to think that a mashal, that's what the word means, that it's a proverb. But in fact, a mashal, if you like, was a type of wisdom writing. And in different contexts, it could be different things. It might be a poem, it might be a prophecy, it might be a parable, it might be a riddle, it might be a satire, it might be a fable. But when Solomon came along, he was going to give a new dimension to the term as well. And what Solomon was going to do was he was now going to make mashal the maxim for daily life. No one had ever done that before. Solomon was going to add this special dimension to the term mashal, which was now under his hand going to become the maxim for daily life. And in writing the book of Proverbs, what Solomon did was he wrote in effect the code for the order of the Hakamim. This was their code of conduct. This was their standard of living. And from this time forth, the wise men in Israel would have recourse to the principles that Solomon had embodied in the book of Proverbs. Wise principles or maxims for daily life. And it's this that was to set Solomon's wisdom apart from the surrounding nations. Oh, they might know all about chemistry and mathematics and astronomy and engineering, but the particular focus of Solomon's wisdom was going to be the wisdom that could be used in daily life. And that's what this man was all about. Here was the man who was going to unlock the moral power of everyday life. That's the key to Solomon's wisdom. A man who had the ability to unlock the moral power of everyday life, to see spiritual lessons in daily circumstance. That's what the book of Proverbs and of Solomon's Mashal in particular is all about. The book of Proverbs is all about the wisdom of experiential knowledge presented as a recipe for successful living. It's not so much intellectual knowledge as the presentation of experiential knowledge. Now we come back to the books of wisdom then that we referred to in our first study when we looked at the influence of Hezekiah upon the writings of the wisdom books. And you'll notice that we've said here that the books of wisdom constitute a thesaurus of experiential knowledge. Now that's what the truth's all about. I mean, the truth is about intellectual knowledges too. We have an intellectual grasp of divine principles. But first and foremost, the truth is all about knowledge applied in life itself. And that's what the books of wisdom are all about. And you see, there is a progressive series of stages here as one moves up through the books. So we have in the book of Job, learning to show patience in affliction. In the book of Psalms, learning to demonstrate confidence in prayer and praise. In the book of Proverbs, learning to practice wisdom in the course of daily life. In the book of Ecclesiastes, how to find satisfaction in obedience to divine commandments. And in the Song of Solomon, the experiencing of fellowship in the outworking of love itself. And the book of Proverbs is the middle step of all of them. It's right at the heart of these wisdom writings. And we believe that the book of Proverbs, therefore, came into being in this middle part of Solomon's life, when he was at the height of his powers, right in the thick of all his activities, busy judging the nation, building buildings, trading with other nations, but he still found time to set down in writing those principles that could be used for the wise governing of the nation. And the emphasis here is on what to do in terms of applying wisdom for daily life. That's what the book of Proverbs is all about. But you see, the focus of the wise ones, or of the Hakamim, was going to be different to the focus of the priest or the prophet. The priest would say, you ought to do something because it's holy. The prophet would say, you ought to do something because it's righteous. But the wise one would say, you ought to do something because it's sensible, because it's prudent, because it's expedient, because it's profitable. And the terms that would be used in the book of Proverbs would focus on the benefits of that wisdom in the course of daily life. And so wisdom is personified in the book of Proverbs as a mature, attractive woman who has many splendid gifts to offer those who befriend her, in contrast to another silly, giggling lady known as Miss Folly. And we're exhorted in the book to lay hold of those principles and to make use of them in the course of daily life. You know, one of the key themes of the book of Proverbs, and a theme which the book explores, in addition to matters of our relationship with God, is the idea of the diversity of human life and of human character. And I think that was something, you see, that had always fascinated Solomon. He was fascinated by the diversity of character that was to be seen in the subjects of his nation. And so we come into the book of Proverbs and we have remarkable descriptions of the fool, the scoffer, the sluggard, the troublemaker, but also the diligent, the upright, the friend, the generous one. All sorts of different types of people are all skillfully painted by Solomon in the book of Proverbs. Some that we might learn to recognize and avoid, others that we might learn to recognize that we might follow. And so you see, in the book of Proverbs, what we have is the sands of the seashore of Solomon's mind. The sands of the seashore of Solomon's mind, all brought together here in a book of daily wisdom. Now, if we come back to the 1st of Kings chapter 4, we just take up the record again in the next verse, verse 32. Remember that verse 32 said that he spake 3,000 proverbs. Of course, not all of those are contained for us in the book of Proverbs. Obviously, some of them have disappeared. We've only retained one of his songs. Which one's that, by the way? The Song of Solomon itself. Obviously, the Song of Songs appears to be the only Song of Solomon's that we have retained of all these 1,005 songs that he wrote, that he spoke or wrote down. But certainly, the book of Proverbs gives us a good part of the Proverbs that Solomon wrote. We believe, obviously, that Solomon wrote the bulk of the book of Proverbs, although there were some other contributory authors. And then verse 33 goes on to say, and he spake of trees from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. He spake also of beasts and of fowls and of creeping things and of fishes. Now, it's been suggested on more than one occasion that what this verse tells us is that Solomon was a great scientist. He was a naturalist, he was a biologist, he was a botanist. He took an interest in all of the things of nature. Well, it's true that the verse says that, but interestingly enough, Josephus adds this comment upon verse 33. Where it says that he spake of trees, Josephus says, for he spake a parable upon every sort of tree, and in like manner also about beasts, when it says later on he spake also of beasts. So what Josephus says is not simply that he spoke about trees, but that he spoke a parable upon every sort of tree, and a parable upon every sort of beast. And I believe that the context shows that that is probably right, because you'll notice how that the word spake in verse 33 is obviously being taken up from verse 32. So you see verse 32, he spake 3,000 proverbs, verse 33, what were they about? Well, he spake of trees, and he spake also of beasts. So I think what the verse is telling us, verse 33, is that Solomon's interest in natural matters was not so much scientific as spiritual. It wasn't so much that he was pursuing the fields of science as an end in themselves, but that he was interested in nature from the point of view of the moral power that could be extracted from those things. He was interested in them in order that he might speak parables or proverbs upon those things. And so by simply colouring in the word spake in verse 32, and the two occasions that it's used in verse 33, appears to perhaps draw that idea together. And that, you see, was always the focus of Solomon's wisdom. Solomon's wisdom was very much about how do we use this in daily life? How do we take up this principle now and find an application to it in daily life? And we go to the book of Proverbs and we have observations, don't we, upon the ant and upon the bee and upon the coney, and upon various animals, and upon various plants. And so here we have the genius of Solomon that's referred to here, finally coming out in the very book of Proverbs itself, in the context of helping us to see spiritual lessons out of the mundane things of everyday life. That is true wisdom. When in the everyday things of ordinary life we can see spiritual lessons, then we have found wisdom. Because if we can do that, and if we can find that, then we've unlocked the key whereby everything in life can become a guide to us in order that we can walk before our Heavenly Father. Now we come to the New Testament, and what do we have? Well, we have the teaching of Christ. Well, in Luke chapter 7 and verse 35, we notice an interesting phrase that the Lord uses in Luke 7 in the context of his own teaching. Luke chapter 7 and verse 35, the end of a little statement he's made. He says, "But wisdom is justified of all her children." Where does that come from? That's obviously the same thing as the personification of wisdom in Proverbs. You'll remember in Proverbs chapter 8 it says, doesn't it? It says, "Does not wisdom cry and understanding put forth her voice? She stands in the top of the high places and cries unto Israel." Proverbs chapter 8 verse 1. She puts forth her voice. The Lord comes upon the face of Israel and takes up his teaching and says, "But wisdom is justified of all her children," and takes up now the theme of wisdom as personified from the book of Proverbs. And the teaching of the Lord in the New Testament was going to be based upon the approach to life that Solomon had shown in his writings. So when the Lord comes to educate the nation in the New Testament, he doesn't take up the law of the priests as the basis of his teaching. He doesn't take up the oracles of the prophets. He takes up the counsels of the wise. And in particular, the maxims of Solomon. And our Lord used Solomon's own teaching formula and Solomon's own approach to wisdom as the basis of his own education in Israel and of Israel. In the New Testament, of course, the Lord is famous for his parables. But the word that's used in the New Testament for parables is the same word used in the Septuagint translation to describe the Proverbs of Solomon. So we could describe Solomon's writings as the parables of Solomon and the parables of Christ, or we could talk about the Proverbs of Solomon and the Proverbs of Christ. The words are interchangeable in their meaning. So Christ took up that same principle and he draws his teaching formula from Solomon, but what in fact he does, I believe, is he actually takes many an idea from the book of Proverbs and builds out of that one of his own stories, which became in fact a parable in the mouth of our Lord. Now look, here's just a few examples just to get you going. This is by no means exhaustive, but I'll tell you what, there must be absolute dozens and dozens of these examples if we really got stuck into it. The story of the rich fool in Luke chapter 12, we believe, is drawn from a phrase in Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 9. We haven't got time to turn all these up, so I'm just going to make reference to them here. But we believe that there was a key phrase in Proverbs 3 verse 9. Along comes Christ in the New Testament, takes that phrase and builds a whole story just out of that one statement from the book of Proverbs. The parable of the friend at midnight in Luke chapter 11 is built out of two verses in Proverbs chapter 3 concerning our duties and responsibilities to one another as friends. And the key statements are taken up there about don't say to your neighbour, "Go and come again, but tomorrow I will give when you've got it. Go and do it now." And those phrases in Proverbs 3 become the essence which the Lord expands out into the story of the friend that came at midnight. In Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 7, we have reference to the fact that the wicked are overthrown and are not, but the house of the righteous shall stand. And again in chapter 14 and verse 11, the house of the wicked shall be overthrown, but the tabernacle of the upright shall flourish. And we believe that those terms became the basis of the parable of the house upon the rock and the house upon the sand, taken up in the Lord's discourse upon the mount in Matthew chapter 7. In Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 20, we're told there that there is treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up. And that phrase which has the word wise and foolish and oil in Proverbs 21 and verse 20, we believe, obviously becomes the basis for the Lord's story upon the wise and foolish virgins that are found in Matthew chapter 25. Proverbs chapter 25. We might just turn to one of these as an example, and I happen to have looked at this one for Bible class recently, so Proverbs chapter 25. Let's just have a look at this one by way of illustration. In Proverbs 25, we have the beginning, in fact, of a new section in the book of Proverbs. They are written by Solomon, but they were copied out by the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, says verse 1. Another connection with Hezekiah and Solomon here. Now, we're told in Proverbs 25 and verse 6, he says, "Put not forth thyself," the margin says, "set not out thy glory." The sense of the Hebrew is don't exalt yourself, don't push yourself forward in the presence of the king, and stand not in the place of great men. For better it is that it be said unto thee, "Come up hither," than that thou shouldest be put lower in the presence of the prince. Now if you come to Luke chapter 14, just see how the Lord took up those terms in Proverbs chapter 25 and wove them into a particular parable that he gave concerning the taking of the lowest seat at the feast. We're just using this one, aren't we, as an illustration of all of these examples. In Luke 14 and verse 7 it says, "And he put forth a parable to those which were bidden, when he marked how they chose out the chief rooms, saying unto them, When thou art bidden of any man to a wedding, sit not down in the highest room, lest a more honourable man than thou be bidden of him. And he that bade thee and him come and say to thee, Give this man place, and thou begin with shame to take the lowest room. But when thou art bidden, go and sit in the lowest room, that when he that bade thee cometh, he may say unto thee, Friend, go up higher. Then thou shalt have worship in the presence of them that sit at meat with thee. For whosoever exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted." Now that whole parable is taken out of Proverbs 25. And if you look at that parable, you'll find that the word place in verse 9, the word lowest in verse 9, the phrase go up higher in verse 10, the word presence in verse 10, the word exalt in verse 11, those words are all extracted precisely from Proverbs chapter 25. Now there's just so many examples of this in the story of the parables. One last one there, Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 7 in the last few chapters of Proverbs says, "Whoso keepeth the law is a wise son, but he that is a companion of riotous men shameth his father." And we believe that that proverb became the basis which was later expanded into the story of the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. Now these are only illustrations, as I've said. Look, you'll be able to find no doubt many more examples. And what a wonderful story to explore for ourselves in terms of taking up those connections of thought between Solomon's proverbs and our Lord's parables, the one being built out of the other. Now, if ever there was an endorsement of the wisdom of Solomon, it is simply this, that when our Lord takes up his own teaching, he models his teaching upon the writings of Solomon. That must be an endorsement, mustn't it? That is true wisdom. When we can find those principles that will help us in daily life. And we believe that it was for that particular reason that the record truly says that Solomon's wisdom exceeded all the wisdom of those that were about him, because he had discovered that particular secret. So Solomon, therefore, was indeed a wise teacher. He didn't just retain all of that knowledge for himself. The purpose of that knowledge was specifically in order that he might give a sensible and wise guidance to the nation. And we believe that under his spirit, that this whole new order of people flowered and developed, those of the Hakamim. And of course, bearing in mind that phrase is referred to in Jeremiah 18, how long after Solomon was Jeremiah? Why, Jeremiah is virtually at the end of the times of the kings, isn't he? Hundreds and hundreds of years after Solomon, we still have the order of the wise ones giving counsel in the nation. But that spirit sprang from the time of Solomon coming upon the throne. Well, of course, as we've said in all of our studies, we believe that these things are a foreshadowing of the work of Christ in the age to come, who will not just be the bridegroom, who will not just be the priest, but who will also be the wise teacher of the nations in the age to come. So we're told in the 1st of Kings chapter 3 and verse 28, and all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had judged, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him. So you see how the wisdom is related to the ability to judge. Those two key words brought together there. And look at Isaiah chapter 11. Isn't that born out of the same spirit? And the spirit of Yahweh shall rest upon Messiah, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, and shall make him of quick understanding, that he might not judge after the sight of his eyes, but with righteousness shall he judge the poor and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. These phrases, by the way, the judging of the poor and the reproving with equity the meek of the earth, are almost borrowed from Psalm 72, aren't they? Again, descriptive of Messiah's reign, but based, in fact, upon the life of Solomon. So Messiah's wisdom will likewise be the key for his ability to judge wisely among the nations, modeled on the life of Solomon, who was, of course, his foreshadowing in these particular matters. And again, just as the record tells us, well, in fact, if you go back to the 1st of Kings chapter 4, the very final verse of 1st of Kings chapter 4, the 34th verse says, and there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all kings of the earth which had heard of his wisdom. Such tremendous knowledge that could be used to give guidance in daily life was sought after by all nations of the earth. And that spirit is taken up in the prophets, isn't it, concerning the age to come. And so just as it says here that there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon, so we're told in Isaiah chapter 2, and all nations shall go up to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us of his ways. Who? The wise king of Jerusalem. That he may teach us of his ways. And because the preacher was wise, says Ecclesiastes, he taught the people good knowledge. And so will Christ exercise his wisdom in a teaching capacity in the age to come. And as a result of teaching them his wisdom, it says, and we will walk in his paths. So you see, the sort of education that's going to be provided by Christ in the age to come is that he will teach his ways that they might walk in his paths. That, in other words, is the wisdom that is seen in daily life, isn't it? It's not intellectual knowledge. It's that experiential knowledge that will translate itself into daily life. These people will come up in the kingdom age to be taught of his ways in order that they might then walk in his paths. the wisdom of daily life. And Isaiah 33 and verse 6 says concerning the reign of Messiah, and wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. So the kingdom age is going to be characterized by a similar, but of course more glorious spirit of wisdom, of which we see nevertheless this wonderful foreshadowing in the life of Solomon of old. And of course, the obvious exhortation is, isn't it, that if we're looking forward to that age to come, it won't just be the king in Jerusalem who dispenses that wisdom. There will be the little hills and the mountains of Psalm 72 who will be spread abroad the face of the earth in order that they might also dispense the wisdom of daily life. How vital for us to see the truth today as an opportunity to learn the spirit of Solomon, to give ourselves to that wisdom that will be translated into practical principles day by day. If we're to be the teachers of the age to come, that's the sort of wisdom we've got to learn. If all our study and all our knowledge of the truth doesn't help us to live the truth better each day, then it has been study in vain. If all our marginal notes do not find for us a principle that we can live in life, then that knowledge is ultimately to no purpose. That's the lesson of Solomon's wisdom, isn't it? It's the key to life itself. And we look forward, brothers and sisters, to that age to come when, as of old, all the nations shall indeed come up to hear and to learn of the wisdom of the King who dwells in Jerusalem.